Tamar Ziff.
And I'm Sanjana Dalal.
And this is Outside the Bubble, your number one news source for everything that happens outside of St. Andrews. Today we'll be reporting on events in the Middle East, but first, some breaking news. Well, some time has elapsed since it occurred, but it's nonetheless still pretty much breaking news.
Chavez, Venezuela's populist dictator, is dead. On Tuesday, March the 5th, 2013, the 58-year-old leader, who had been loved and hated with equal passion by poor Venezuelans and the middle class, respectively, succumbed to his debilitating cancer and passed away, leaving an immense vacuum of power at the helm of Venezuela, which his vice president, Nicolas Maduro, is struggling to fill. Thousands of Venezuelans flooded to the streets on Tuesday night to publicly mourn the death of the man who had firmly controlled Venezuela for 14 years. He had just been re-elected, again, in October of last year. By then, however, he was already weakened by cancer and continued to deteriorate in the following months. Last week, we talked about how he was battling death, and now it appears he is lost, to the dismay of many. Though a controversial leader, Chavez served as a bastion for social change, instituting multiple welfare programs and subsidizing staple food products in order to improve the quality of life for the poor in Venezuela. He significantly mitigated the percentage of Venezuelans destitute and even moderate poverty, and was therefore interminably lauded as a leader and effector of positive change.
On Wednesday, Chavez's corpse was paraded through the streets in a procession that began at the hospital at which he died and ended at a military academy which he once attended. The body will remain on display at said academy until Friday. Thousands of mourning Venezuelans flocked to the funeral procession, and many were seen the next day queuing patiently outside of the academy in anticipation of a final farewell to their beloved authoritarian leader. The course of his illness, diagnosed in June of 2011, was largely shrouded in mystery, with few details of it released. Now, after his death, various accounts from government officials are being released, including descriptions of Chavez's final few days. In a cruel twist of fate, Chavez contracted some sort of lung infection the weeks prior to his death and had trouble breathing, much less speaking. He approached death silently, in sharp contrast with the manner in which he reigned Venezuela. He was constantly speaking, holding record 9-hour press conferences, in which his was the sole voice heard. An eccentric man, he maintained popularity through a form of charismatic legitimacy. Somewhat like the authoritarian leaders in Soviet Russia or Nazi Germany, which were centered around one main fundamental figure during the 20th century, his erratic behavior was offset by a gift for oratory and an uncomplicated platform, just, you know, food, money for the people, which evoked adulation from audiences. Though he was the head of a party, a political faction, the Fifth Republic Party, subordinate officials and other government bodies had little influence in Venezuelan policymaking and were largely ignored throughout his presidency. Chavez adored and embraced the spotlight, taking every opportunity to promote his socialist creed and lambast imperial America. Though many hope that Chavista policies may continue under Maduro, the vice president, it is unlikely that the Chavez regime, which was based largely on his characteristic appeal, will succeed without the man himself.
Maduro, perpetuating the Chavista tradition of antagonism towards the United States, expelled two American diplomatic attaches on Wednesday, claiming that they were attempting to galvanize Chavez's opposition and destabilize the country. In fact, the vice president has recently claimed that Chavez's enemies for causing his cancer and insists that the source of the illness be thoroughly investigated. Chavez himself has expressed the opinion that his cancer was a result of some malign plot to undermine his power. Though utterly preposterous, these statements can be interpreted as a manifestation of Maduro's anxiety about the future of Venezuelan government. According to the Constitution, the death of a president almost immediately after his election calls for a new election, which is scheduled to occur in about a month's time. Henrique Capriles, who champions the Venezuelan middle class and an increase in government transparency and public participation, is the leader of the opposition party. And though he could not defeat the Chavez in the October elections, the upcoming vote gives the opposition hope that change is possible. Most political analysts agree that Maduro does not capture the Venezuelan people's hearts, as Chavez did, yet he stands a good chance of winning due to his staunch dedication to Chavez's legacies and policies.
General José Ornella, the head of Venezuelan's presidential guard, was with Chavez during his final moments and claimed that his last words, which Chavez simply mouthed as he couldn't not produce sounds, were, "I don't want to die. Please don't let me die." It's quite sad. A controversial figure, intolerant of dissent or Americans, Chavez nonetheless changed the Venezuelan socioeconomic demographic, vastly improving education and living standards, and though inciting hatred abroad and allowing security and civil society to stagnate, inspiring love in the many he helped out of desperate poverty. Maduro, the acting president, is already beginning to emulate Chavez, adopting his speaking style and wearing similar clothing. However, attire and governance are two entirely different things, and it is yet to be seen whether Maduro will take individual initiative or remain forever an ersatz Chavez. Already, many hidden facts about the former president are coming to the fore, such as the fact that, despite his loud denunciations of the United States, Chavez painstakingly ensured that business negotiations between the U.S. and Venezuela, mainly concerning the oil sector, ran smoothly.
This past November, the United States made moves to mitigate the diplomatic tensions between the two nations, holding informal meetings in Washington with Maduro. The offer to exchange ambassadors, the last American ambassador was kicked out of Venezuela in 2009, was put on the table by the Venezuelans, but the American officials were hesitant. At the beginning of 2013, talks stalled as Chavez's condition took turns for the worse, and now the situation seems rather bleak. In an effort to unify a heartbroken Venezuela, Maduro has used inflammatory rhetoric against the U.S. and is becoming increasingly intransigent towards any reform that veers from Chavez's party line.
Also, in a simultaneously moving and delusional gesture, Iran's president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad sent a letter to the Venezuelan people assuring them that Chavez will eventually be resurrected, along with Jesus and the hidden Imam, who is a holy figure in Shiite Islam, Iran's majority religion. He declared a day of national mourning in Iran to honor the achievements of the late Venezuelan president. In the letter, Ahmadinejad wrote, "Chavez is a name known to all nations that remind us of purity, kindness, courage, heroism, love, dedication to the people, and tireless efforts to serve the people, especially the poor and those scarred by colonialism and imperialism." Venezuela and Iran became close over their mutual antagonism towards the United States. However, multiple Iranian government officials criticized their president's message as overly melodramatic. One cleric has stated that a diplomatic expression of condolence would have sufficed, and that invoking ideological figures like Jesus and the hidden Imam is grossly exaggerated.
Still, with the elections on the horizon, there is still a slim possibility that Chavez's regime will be put to rest with its leader. Anyways, here's a song.
It's a reggaeton, which is like Venezuela's main music genre. So this is by Alexis y Fido. No, Calle 13, actually.
Okay, cool.
Anyway, meanwhile, in the Middle East, a piece of biblical history seems to be repeating itself. Recently, swarms of locusts have infested fields in multiple areas around Egypt, devastating crops and consuming the livelihood of Egyptian farmers. The locusts have done what, under the Morsi regime, people can no longer do and cross the border to Israel, concentrating in small villages within and around the Negev Desert. The timing of the locusts is eerily fitting, as they arrive about 3 weeks before the Jewish holiday of Passover, or Pesach, commemorating the escape of Hebrew slaves from Egypt many millennia ago. The story found in the Old Testament, in Exodus, features a Jewish man named Moses, who was abandoned at birth by his mother so that they would not be killed by Egyptian authorities, who were trying to reduce the population growth of the Hebrew slaves in order to prevent the possibility of popular revolt. He is then found and adopted by an Egyptian queen and believes himself to be a native-born royal. Once he discovers his Jewish roots, however, he escapes into the desert, becoming a shepherd. After an encounter with God in the form of a burning bush, Moses is given divine orders to free the Jews from the yoke of Egyptian slavery and returns to the kingdom to plead with Pharaoh for their release. All right, to be honest, I haven't actually read Exodus. This is like, I get these facts from The Prince of Egypt, which is the Disney version of the movie. And I'm guessing it's relatively accurate. And if not, I apologize to our listeners.
Well, I'm going to take your word for it because... Yeah. Anyways, according to Exodus, Pharaoh refuses to Moses' request, and despite the performing of multiple miracles as evidence of God's support, Pharaoh really wants to keep his free labor. So through Moses, God unleashes the 10 plagues. First, he turns Egypt's water into blood. Second, there is a massive influx of frogs. Quote, "And the river shall bring forth frogs abundantly, which shall go up and come into thine house and into thy bedchamber, and I cross thy bed."
This reminds me of, I mean, this is quite irrelevant, but it reminds me of that news clip that went viral about a year ago. In response to an attempted rape of a woman in Huntsville, Alabama in April 2012, as she was sleeping in her bed with a child, the eccentric and now famous Antoine Dodson warned the denizens of Huntsville to hide your kids, hide your wife, because they rape an body out there. You've probably heard about this. Mm. Did you not hear that? Did this not go viral in Britain?
No.
Anyway,
it was. I love how this just comes to your mind as well. It reminds me of this story.
Well, this is just, it's just internet fodder. It was turned into a rather inappropriately humorous meme, hide your kids, hide your wife, and a song called Bed Intruder. Now, apparently, the frogs in Exodus were the original bed intruders. You see how I make these connections?
Okay. Cool. Back to the plagues, anyways. Third, the gnats and lice. Fourth, flies to feed the frogs, maybe. Mm-hmm. Fifth, disease to livestock. Sixth, boils. Seven, thunder and hail. And the eighth, locusts. 9 and 10 are darkness and the killing of the firstborn. So strangely enough, the eighth plague is now afflicting Egypt and Israel. Not 20 days before it originally happened, supposedly over 2,000 years ago. Potato farmers in Israel complained about their ruined harvest, and drivers reported that their driving was impaired due to locusts flying into the windshield and obscuring the view of the road. Meanwhile, Thai agricultural workers in Israel are embracing the influx of locusts, frying and eating them, as crunchy snacks.
You know, it's just it's a different culture. Some people eat locusts, apparently.
No, it's just, vegetarian, but anyways.
Insects
are surely off limits.
Bugs are they off limits?
Yes, of course. But I never really thought about it. Yes, definitely.
All right. Okay.
Well, no, actually, if you think about it, the beetle's blood that's in the Smarties, so you don't eat Smarties.
What?
You know, some confectionery makers.
Yeah, they put beetle's blood.
Well, no, for the dye, for the red dye, apparently.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, do you not eat
Smarties? No. Well, I don't like them, but I also don't
eat them. Okay, all right, fair enough.
Apparently, the locusts had originated in Sudan and travelled north to search for food. Israeli scientists and entomologists predicted that due to the comparatively cold climate of Israel, they will not survive for long.
Crazy stuff. That didn't have much political or really even global relevance, but it was interesting enough. And a reminder that I'm going to have to listen to the recitation of the 10 plagues, as well as the lengthy tale of Jewish exodus in about 3 weeks' time when I celebrate Pesach, because I'm Jewish.
Oh, yeah. What do you have to do for that?
It's like a big dinner, and we eat the foods that apparently, supposedly, like the slaves that escaped eat. We eat these things called matzahs, which is unrisen bread. So it's like a big cracker, because supposedly, you know, they put the bread in the oven, but they didn't have time to rise because the Egyptians were coming. So they just took the bread out of the oven and ate it like a cracker. I mean, it's quite good. Hmm. Supposedly, like, really Orthodox Jews aren't even supposed to eat bread throughout this time, you know, in respect for our ancestors. But, well, I usually eat bread, but I also eat matzah, which is quite good.
So wait. So on the day you're not supposed to eat bread if you're really Orthodox, or in the lead up as well?
I think in the lead up as well. You're just not supposed to eat bread during Pesach. And you just sit around and you tell the story. There's like a special book that you have to read, going through the motions. You have to wash your hands multiple times and dip the wine in special places and the matzah. And so it's big. It's very ceremonial, and it's, you know, showing respect for our ancestors that succeeded in escaping from Egypt. Mm. It's kind of a pain, though, sometimes, because you have to wait until you finish the story to eat. So the food's, like, right in front of you, but you can't eat until you finish the story. It's a long story, dude. So, yeah. Mm. Anyway.
I guess that's patience. Continue. Anyways, in far less frivolous news, a new UNICEF report claims that the Palestinian children are being systematically mistreated by Israeli soldiers. The report estimates that approximately 700 Palestinian children aged 12 to 17 have been detained, some of them interrogated, physically or verbally abused, or coerced into false confessions. This treatment violates international human rights laws and is therefore being thoroughly investigated both by the United Nations Children's Fund and by the Israeli Foreign Ministry.
Meanwhile, the annual fundraising marathon in Gaza, in its third year after being initiated by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency in 2010, has been cancelled due to the recent decree prohibiting the participation of women. Hamas, the terrorist group which has controlled the Gaza Strip since about 2007, is ideologically conservative and therefore seeks to place women in their traditional Muslim roles, which precludes participation in marathons because they supposedly promote immodesty and the unregulated interaction of men and women. Of the 2,400 registered to run in the marathon, a mere 250 were women from Gaza, and they were prevented from doing so. The UN agency is now seeking alternative activities to occupy the women, expressing their disappointment at Hamas's antiquated views. Many women that had intended to run in the race, religious women, are angry at the government because they think that Hamas has a warped interpretation of Islam, and that the religion itself, Islam, you know, as seen, does not prohibit the participation of women in sporting activities. Currently, Hamas is at odds with the powerless Fatah, the moderate-leaning party headed by Mahmoud Abbas, who is also the chair of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Abbas hopes that reconciliation will come soon, but that seems unlikely in the increasingly reactionary climate of the Middle East that has accompanied the rise to power of Islamic parties following the Arab Spring. That's quite sad that they can't participate in the marathon. I didn't even know they held a marathon. Apparently, it's been going on for 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah, and apparently most of the, a lot, about 1,600 of the participants are children. It gives children something to do in Gaza. But a lot of them, I think, are also just volunteers from abroad. And it's supposed to raise money for the, you know, for the relief of Palestinian refugees. Mm. Anyway, today apparently is National Women International Women's Day.
Yep.
So now, in further unsettling news, it seems that 21 UN peacekeepers from the Philippines were abducted by Syrian rebels on Wednesday as they patrolled the Golan Heights, a demilitarized area on the border between Syria and Israel. They were a part of the United Nations Disengagement Observer Force, sent to check on an observer post that had been evacuated this past weekend due to heavy fighting in close proximity of the post. This is the first time during the conflict that peacekeepers have been targeted. The rebel group, identifying themselves as the Martyrs of Yarmouk, demanded the withdrawal of the Syrian government forces from the area around Al-Jamla, where the weekend fighting had occurred. If their demands were not complied with within 24 hours, the rebel group threatened to harm the peacekeepers and treat them like prisoners of war.
This event highlights the growing severity of the situation in Syria. An estimated 1 million Syrian refugees have now fled to neighboring countries, with an approximate 7,000 to 8,000 leaving the country per day. 330 Syrians have gone to Iraq, 320 to Jordan, 185,000 in Turkey, and 105,000 in Iraq, 43,000 in Egypt, and about 8,000 in various countries in North Africa. Resources available to refugees in each of these countries are fast becoming overstretched, and patience is thinning in the Middle East as the exodus of Syrians seems interminable. Accommodation is insufficient, displacement of resident citizens due to Syrians seeking asylum is a continuous problem, and energy and water supplies are running dangerously low. In December, the United Nations appealed for $1.5 billion to aid Syrian refugees, but has only received about 20% of that sum. Now, in light of the increasing rate of immigration, even the original estimate seems insufficient to cover the costs of a crumbling country.
Violence is surging at an unprecedented speed. On Monday, 40 Syrian government soldiers who sought safety in Iraq were killed in an ambush by rebels as Iraqi soldiers transported them back to Syria. The Syrian conflict has now raged on for about 2 years and has claimed the lives of over 70,000 people. British Foreign Secretary William Hague expressed the UK's willingness to provide non-lethal weapons and tanks to reinforce the security of the peacekeeping mission and prevent civilian casualties. Diplomacy is taking far too long, Hague said. Indeed, it seems that foreign policy decisions, such as the Arab League awarding Syria's seat to the opposition party, have done little to undermine the legitimacy, at least the military legitimacy, of the Assad regime or inspire any kind of withdrawal or willingness to compromise. So long as the military remains loyal to Assad, the fighting will continue and the rebels will become more and more desperate.
Terrible times, unfortunately.
Do you just want to move on then?
Yeah, should we go on to the next one?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going back to Egypt, actually. And their news that their electoral commission has cancelled the dates for parliamentary elections, which has been scheduled to begin next month, states TV reports. And the move comes after a court ruled that the electoral law backed by President Mohamed Morsi needed to be reviewed by the Supreme Constitutional Court. Morsi last month announced that the polls would take place in four stages over 2 months, starting on the 22nd of April. The main opposition, however, said it would boycott these elections.
The National Salvation Front, the NSF, argues that the electoral law favors the president's Islamist allies, a claim Mr. Morsi denies. The NSF also expresses concern that the elections would be neither free nor fair. Earlier this week, the Cairo Administrative Court ruled that the country's highest court must rule on the electoral law's conformity to the Constitution. President Morsi later said he respected the ruling and that an appeal was unlikely.
Egypt remains sharply polarized between the governing Islamists and secular opposition. More than 70 people were killed in recent weeks in clashes between security forces and opposition supporters at protests held across the country to mark the second anniversary of the revolution, which removed Hosni Mubarak in February 2011.
The latest wave of protests began thanks to demonstrations that took place in Cairo, Alexandria, and other major cities to mark the second anniversary of the 25th of January uprising that unseated Hosni Mubarak. These soon turned into protests against Mr. Morsi. Liberals and other opponents of the president accused the new Islamist leader from the Muslim Brotherhood, who was elected last year, of betraying the revolution. There is widespread disaffection at the manner in which a new constitution was rushed through parliamentary approval and a referendum, and with the way Mr. Morsi is using his presidential powers.
In Port Said, at the northern end of the Suez Canal, riots began on Saturday after a court sentenced 21 local people to death for their role in last February's football violence. Over 70 people were killed after a match between Al Masri clubs playing at home to Cairo's Al Ahli. Relatives of those convicted attacked police and the prison where the men were held. Soldiers were then brought in to guard strategic sites, and there were further clashes on Sunday at the funerals for more than 30 people who were killed, and the unrest spread to Ismailia and Port Suez. Locals in Port Said argue that the authorities responsible for security at the ill-fated football match have not been brought to justice, and that the prosecuted Al Masri fans are scapegoats.
On Sunday night, the president gave a televised address announcing a state of emergency in three cities along the Suez Canal: Port Said, Ismailia, and Port Suez. He ordered a nighttime curfew to stay in place for 30 days. Since then, the cabinet has given the president powers to deploy the armed forces on the streets, to participate with the police in preserving security and protecting vital establishments. The former is a quote.
Morsi has also called the opposition to talks at the presidential palace in an attempt to restore national unity. And they include parties from across the political spectrum, from Islamists to liberals to leftists. And his most powerful opponents are still the NSF. And the protests are thought to be stemming from a loss of confidence in state institutions, especially the security and judicial systems.
These reports come alongside the rather happier note that two British tourists who were kidnapped in Egypt on the way to the beach resort have been freed. The pair was thought to have been in the car traveling from Cairo to the Sharm el-Sheikh resort, and they were seized near the city of Ras Sidr. The Foreign Office had said it was looking into the kidnap reports. This came amid reports which we clearly can see that security in the desert island region has deteriorated since the overthrow of President Hosni Mubarak 2 years ago.
And the pair are known to be a man aged 51 and a woman who is 49. And the AFP news agency said they were husband and wife, adding that the kidnappers told reporters that they wanted the release of four people held over arms trafficking. Egyptian Bedouins have pressed for the release of captive tribesmen they say have been sentenced unfairly on charges ranging from terrorism to drug dealing and people trafficking across the border into Israel.
Yeah, no. The Bedouins were also affected in Egypt by the locust crisis. They're complaining that their crops of cumin are being eaten. But I suppose that's a bit more frivolous than this. All right, now, moving on to Iraq now. The U.S. is seeing that the rebuilding effort in Iraq achieved little despite $60 million, £40 million, spent since the 2003 invasion, a U.S. auditor for reconstruction has said. In his final report, the Inspector General for Iraq, George Venizelo, said reconstruction estimated that the U.S. wasted at least $8 billion. Stuart Bowen put the limited positive effects down to corruption, poor security, and insufficient consultation with Iraqi authorities. The eight-year war in Iraq cost the U.S. about $800 billion and nearly 5,000 lives.
In learning from Iraq, a final report to the U.S. Congress before his office seizes operations, Mr. Bowen says that the failure in Iraq offers lessons for reconstruction efforts elsewhere. The U.S. plans to withdraw combat troops from Afghanistan by the end of 2014. The report was based on hundreds of audits and inspections across Iraq, as well as dozens of interviews with Iraqi and American officials and politicians.
The general belief across each group is that the relief and reconstruction program should have accomplished more, that too much was wasted, and that the lessons derived from Iraq reconstruction experience should drive improvements to the U.S. approach to stabilization and reconstruction operations elsewhere, Mr. Bowen reported.
Iraqi Prime Minister told Mr. Bowen that there had been a misspending of U.S. money. The U.S.-funded rebuilding program could have brought great change in Iraq, he said, but fell short. Osama al-Nujaifi, Speaker of the Israeli Parliament and the
Israeli Parliament?
Oh, sorry, Iraqi Parliament. And the country's top Sunni Muslim official said rebuilding projects had unfavorable outcomes in general. And Kurdish official Kubad Talabani told auditors, "You think if you throw money at a problem, you can fix it. It was just not strategic thinking."
So long after 2003, a decade after, actually, this is 2013, Iraq still remains a contentious issue. And aside from the excessive amounts of money it has spent, it is still considered a morally debatable decision. I know for a fact that the British people were largely opposed to Blair's invasion of Iraq alongside
George
Bush.
I remember there was a lot of people that camped out for a long time in London.
Yeah?
Yeah, against Iraq. And they had their little tents and their signs and everything, and they would try and tell you about it. I'm a little bit outside London. Well, I'm on the tube map, but it's suburbs kind of thing. And even there, you would get like flyers and that kind of stuff being handed out.
And I mean, did you get informed about it, or do you have right now an opinion about it? Do you think it was a bad idea?
There was definitely misinformation, because I was very young at the time, obviously, when all the stuff was happening, but there was a lot on the television about weapons of mass destruction, and I think that was the main thing that kind of stuck with the British public. And then also it was quite soon after 9/11 and so on, so the idea of any more attacks
or any really more kind of wars or getting yourself involved in the Middle East was just...
It really scared people, so people were more susceptible, I think, to just go along with whatever, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They were more inclined to believe that. But, I mean, were you in America at the time? Or?
2003, I was just finishing third grade in Peru. So no, I wasn't in the States. It was just before I moved to the States, though. And I don't know. I know for a fact that a lot of people initially were very, very much pro-invasion. I mean, especially, you know, under the Bush administration, people thought that there were weapons of mass destruction. They thought that, you know, Saddam Hussein was an antagonistic figure. There was the Gulf War in 1991 under George Bush Sr. Now George Bush Jr. has to finally and conclusively end Saddam's regime. I don't know. I saw a very troubling movie called The Devil's Double, and it was about Saddam Hussein's son, I think, in the 1980s and also later in Iraq, and the way that the Saddam Hussein treated his people is deplorable. It was genocidal. It was crazy. I think that, however, back in 2003, it was still not accepted in international law to invade a country for humanitarian reasons. It was still a violation of sovereignty. So the United States, I think, came up with a reason to do it as a matter of international security. Now, I think that some people in the government definitely did believe that there were weapons of mass destruction, but you're right, it was just mismanaged. Evidence wasn't concrete. You'd had soldiers in there looking, you know, going into warehouses, testing kind of the air for, you know, nuclear residue, and they didn't find anything. It really seemed like they invaded for the wrong reasons, and I think that is one of the reasons that people are quite antagonistic towards the decision. Because it seems that the United States just felt like invading and then made up a reason to do it. But I do think that taking Saddam Hussein out of power was ultimately a good decision. I mean, I think
something would have happened eventually.
I don't know. I mean, we look at track records. Dictators stay in power for a long time. Look at Assad.
Mm.
2 years. He's still not. There's a civil war.
Well, I mean, potentially, I guess, like, you could argue, like, what if Saddam had stayed in power and then the Arab Spring had kind of crossed over into Iraq? And then
yeah, but that would have been 6 years later.
That's true.
How would the country have fared?
But then is it the West's, like, duty?
Again, I do think the United States has a bit of a hero complex. A little bit of a, we need to save all these countries, we need to enforce democracy in all these countries, and a lot of criticisms.
But that's also Western democracy, so that technically these Eastern countries could say, we've got a system going.
No.
Where, well, I'm sorry, I'm sure not.
No, definitely,
People were happy with them.
You.
Yeah, I know. But at the same time, you can understand both.
No, both sides. I think that a lot of people, like, there, especially in Afghanistan, the system of government is really working, because Afghanistan it was founded on, like, tribalism. There wasn't, they didn't have a democracy. They weren't built for a democracy. And the people there, I don't think, don't want a democracy. Mm. So we're trying to implement kind of made in America government on all these different countries with many, many different cultural and traditional origins.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, we hope, I don't know, I mean, even Winston Churchill said, democracy isn't perfect, but it's the best, you know, of all evils, basically. It's the best of all forms of government. I think that I do agree with it, because it does give an opportunity for people to speak, but I don't know. I mean, sometimes democracy gives an opportunity for tyranny, like you see in Venezuela. Chavez absolutely destroyed the Venezuelan civil society, the infrastructure, but he was democratically voted into office.
Oh, yeah.
People really liked him. So sometimes there's the tyranny of the majority. I don't know, though. I mean, I think that it's a good thing that we have troops out of Iraq. I think that soon, hopefully, we'll take our American embassy out of Iraq as well. But for now, I don't know. I'm just looking forward to, I guess, the return of all the soldiers in Afghanistan next year.
Yeah.
I think that will make a lot of people very happy.
Mm. Okay. And on that note, we're going to have another song.
Okay.
Okay, so for the final story of the hour, a man described as a spokesperson for Osama bin Laden has been arrested and will be tried in New York City, the US has confirmed. Suleiman Abu Ghaith, who was captured within the last week in Jordan, Congressman Peter King said on Thursday, and he is bin Laden's son-in-law and played a role in plotting the attacks of 9/11.
Bin Laden was killed in a May 2011 raid on his hideout in Pakistan in Abbottabad. Gave birth to many jokes, like, talk about a bad place to hide.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it's quite terrible. It's very in bad taste. Anyway, by a team of U.S. commandos, he was killed by Navy SEALs. If you want to see the telling of the operation, watch the movie Zero Dark Thirty. It's quite a good movie, actually. I saw it. It's long. It's just a movie about the operation, how it was planned, how it came into being, how the CIA basically planned it out.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, Mr. Abu Ghaith is scheduled to appear in a federal court on Friday on charges of conspiracy to kill U.S. nationals. Suleiman Abu Ghaith held a key position in al-Qaeda, comparable to the consigliere in a mob family or propaganda minister in a totalitarian regime, said FBI Assistant Director in Charge George Venizelos in a statement. He used his position to threaten the United States and incite its enemies.
U.S. authorities have released little information about Mr. Abu Ghaith's capture, but Turkish newspaper Hürriyet reported that he was caught on his way to Kuwait shortly after leaving Turkey. According to the paper, he had already been taken into custody more than a month ago in Turkish capital Ankara, but police decided to release him because he had not committed any crime. U.S. officials, however, said that Mr. Abu Ghaith had threatened further attacks similar to 9/11. Reports indicate that the FBI took the lead control in the operation as part of a multi-agency body, the High Value Detainee Interrogation Group. The group was set up after President Barack Obama shut down a controversial CIA program which had detained suspects in a network of secret prisons under George W. Bush's administration.
Specifically, on the 12th of September 2001, he appeared with bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri to warn the U.S. that a great army is gathering against you, and called upon the Nation of Islam to do battle against the Jews, the Christians, and the Americans, according to court records. He was reportedly smuggled to Iran with two other senior al-Qaeda leaders in 2002. Unconfirmed reports said the Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, held them under house arrest. A Jordanian security official told the Associated Press that Mr. Abu Ghaith was handed over last week to U.S. officials under both countries' extradition treaties. Mr. King called the arrest a very significant victory in the fight against al-Qaeda.
Mr. Abu Ghaith's trial will mark one of the first prosecutions of senior al-Qaeda leaders on U.S. soil. Since 9/11, 67 foreign terror suspects have been convicted in U.S. federal courts, according to data obtained by the group Human Rights First.
How are we for time?
We can finish now.
We can finish?
Yeah, it's 1:55.
All right, then. Well, just a quick end to it. Have you heard of Guantanamo Bay, right?
Yeah.
And the huge conspiracies over Guantanamo Bay. Is it just a concern for, Americans or people in America, or do people abroad are also kind of know about it and think about it and consider it kind of undermining the legitimacy of United States efforts to, promote human rights and judicial fairness in the world? Because in Guantanamo Bay, supposedly many terrorist suspects, quote unquote, were being held, some of them just taken because they looked Arab or had perceived connections that were later completely unvalidated and unconfirmed.
I'm not gonna know.
You don't know?
No, because okay, Guantanamo Bay, I don't know much about, but which is quite bad actually. But I think people think eventually it's gonna be shut down, but I think it's a case of timing.
I suppose because I think a lot of people thought that Obama would shut it down in his first term, but he hasn't. And that was one of the main criticisms of the Romney campaign back last year, that he has promised the closing of Guantanamo Bay and the kind of resurrection of proper justice and, innocent until proven guilty kind of thing that the United States supposedly was founded upon. But it's still open. And some people claim that illegal, interrogation practices like waterboarding are still done there. If you see the movie Zero Dark Thirty, actually, you'll see that before a certain date, I'm not sure, I think before 2004 or so, waterboarding was kind of not really accepted, but it was more or less accepted. And then they started clamping down on interrogation bases in like Pakistan and Afghanistan, because you had different non-governmental organizations investigating into the practices of United States officials and interrogators. But yeah, generally, I don't know. I think it's seen in a bad light everywhere.
Yeah.
Right then, that is the end of our show. We will leave you for another week. Hope everyone is voting for student election stuff. Are you voting for student election stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So hope everyone's voting for student election stuff. See you next week. Thanks for listening. Please like us on Facebook. Comment if you like the songs, didn't like the songs, have a suggestion for a song, news stories. Are we covering good things? Are we not covering good things? Are we annoying? Are we uninformed? We don't know. Please tell us. Anyway.
Well, we probably are, actually. It's quite bad. Anyways, whatever. Yeah, we'll see you next week.
Okay, bye.